All right, good morning, everybody. It is Monday morning, February 7th, 8 a.m. And this is supposed to be our last week online. I'm not exactly sure if that's how it's going to work out. We're going to wait and see. All we can do is hope for the best and that the administration makes the call that we get to go back in person next week. So with that, next Monday is a national holiday. Next Monday is President's Day. So we have no class next Monday, neither online nor in person. Wednesday morning, we are supposed to go back to in-person instruction and meet in the lab at 8 a.m. in room 607. 607 is on the ocean side of the 600 building, closest to the parking lots. And basically, we'll be starting from scratch at that point. So this... we're coming up on our last couple of meetings, and I'm not sure today's going to be a bit of a shorter meeting for us today, just because content wise, I don't want to go too much into the lab content because we're going to be repeating all of that. That doesn't make sense to repeat it all, but I keep trying to give you what I can here online before we go into in person. And that means that we can use a little bit of the end of this class time to work on some problems for lecture. If we want, we can do a little bit of that. I have those SI problems that were handed out last Friday for SI. We could go over some of those if you'd like. Today, what I thought I would do is, we talked about labeling last time and how to read labels and how to read labels for all the safety stuff that needs to happen. What I thought I would do is talk about waste today and the labeling, both of personal samples and of waste. Those are two critical elements to talk about in terms of labeling. So let's do that. Let me go ahead and start a screen share and drop out this part. And I should check in and see how you guys are doing too. I haven't really asked. You guys can throw comments into the chat if you want. Or Clarissa, you've got a raised hand. Checking in with you now seems like an appropriate time. What do you got?
Oh yeah. Well, good morning. I actually want to ask for SI. Does our SI leader actually upload like any the notes that, you know, from just like each like SI session, just to upload them like right after the sessions?
So she doesn't have a place to upload them. She can pass them to me and I can upload them. I have the exercises that you guys did for SI, and mm-hmm. I have a spot on the website that I was going to create to put SI materials so that all of those can be linked there. I could also create a component in Canvas where those will be linked to where they get posted on the website. So similar to the way that we're putting the lectures up and everything, we can do the same thing with the SI sessions. It's a little bit harder when she does the recordings for me to get the recordings because the recordings are so large. So passing the recordings between both of us is a little bit more complicated. And this last session didn't get recorded, but I do have the exercises that I'll put up online. And I can later on today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Okay. Anybody else have anything? All right, let's see if I can make things work this morning. My brain is not where it needs to be. I am fuzzy this morning. Let's go to... Okay, lab notes, create a new lab note. And let's do labeling. Of samples and waste. Now, when we went through the whole HAZCOM plan, which is what we did last time, that was labeling even for small containers that were used by lots of people. So we should say here that containers used by lots of people or placed in storage. Fall under HazCom. Which HazCom stands for the Hazard Communications. This is what we did last Wednesday. So all of that would be the name, the pictogram, the hazard statement, or even before the hazard statement is the signal word, hazard statements. And contact info. So any sample that is being stored for a longer period of time, or maybe many people may come into contact with and need to deal with, needs to have all of that labeling that we talked about the last time. And when I say name, this is the chemical name, not your name. So all that stuff must be on the label. And sometimes it's more than one pictogram, and the hazard statements can be many hazard statements that need to be on there. So this is normally being done by the stockroom staff for those types of samples. So generally you don't need to get too involved in this unless we're taking a sample that is one of your samples that we're storing, and then I'll need to help you to make sure that that gets labeled properly. But this is usually the what we call the staff keeps changing their names. They just had a job change too. So now they're called laboratory coordinators. So that's who does that part. The labeling of samples and waste, and these are personal samples. Personal samples must all be labeled. But not to the HazCom standards. Waste we'll talk about specifically in a little bit. So every time you obtain a chemical from someplace in the laboratory, if you were going to the fume hood and you're obtaining some acetone or methanol or ethanol, if you're going to the balances and you're collecting some solid samples, every sample that you bring back to your benchtop needs to be labeled. In case there's an accident and we need to know what it is, we need to be able to identify what it is fairly quickly, and we need to be able to figure out what that sample is without communicating with you. Sometimes in the state of an accident, you can not be very communicative. And sometimes it's very easy to get samples confused. And so we need to be able to look at the sample and know immediately what that sample is without communicating with you. So most of the time that includes individual test tubes when we have them in test tube racks. That includes the reaction vessels. Sometimes those reaction vessels are 5 or 3 mil conical vials. Those things have ground glass or threaded tops on them. This can be round bottoms. Sometimes it's the small Erlenmeyer flasks, which are containing things, beakers. Every piece of glassware that you're utilizing should have a label on it. And I would even take this down to saying that a lot of times when we're working with many different pipettes, it's a good idea to keep track of the pipettes and what pipette has been used for what chemical. And so we oftentimes keep our pipettes in a secondary containment to make it a little bit easier so they're not laying on the desktop. And then we will even put a label on the outside of those pipettes, such that we put a little piece of tape on it here that tells us what that thing is. There's a pipette bulb that goes on the top of those guys. But each of these should include a label. And the question is, all right, where do we get all these labels? How do we make all these labels? Labels are generally made out of tape. We use just a masking tape. Usually we have two sources. We have Avery labels. Avery labels are small sticky back labels that you just peel off. And the other one that we use the majority of the time is just masking tape. Masking tape is quick, easy, and we just tear it off to the appropriate size and then apply it to the sample container. The main thing though is what you use to write on the labels with. That organic solvents, and this is really important, organic solvents dissolve ink. And because organic solvents dissolve ink, anything that you write in ink, if the container is damaged in any way and the contents spill, the label becomes unreadable. So the ink is just dissolved by the solvents themselves. So what we do is we label everything in pencil. So we always have to have pencils around. The pencil is made out of carbon. And so these are carbon graphite. And carbon graphite does not dissolve. With organic solvents. So even in a spill, those labels are still readable. Which is the key thing. So then what needs to be on a label? When you take a sample out of a bottle, say we're going and we're getting acetone. And the acetone has, I believe, pictograms that are the ones where they have a starburst on the center like that. This would have danger. It would have all the signal words on it and statement, hazard statements that are on it. And you're retrieving this material and you're retrieving it into a beaker. And you're just taking 20 mils of it or 25 mils. Then what you need to do is you need to put a label on this in tape. Usually we put a little bit higher. I'm just trying to put the volume on there, but it needs to say acetone and that's it. It doesn't need to say anything else. It just needs to have the chemical name on the label. So everything winds up getting labeled. Oftentimes what we do is because the names are, sometimes the names are longer and sometimes we have common abbreviations for the names. So another example that we use a lot, methanol, ethanol. Actually, rather than redrawing all of that, I'll just grab this. We'll just change the label on it. Let's say that this one is methanol. And instead of danger, we'll say warning. And on this one, let's say that we're putting this into a 25 mil round bottom to do a chemical reaction with. And what we would do here is we might put MEOH, which is the abbreviation for methanol. So many of the solvents have some standard abbreviations. So the standard abbreviations for some of the common solvents that we have, I don't know that I'll hit them all, but let me go through some of them. Methanol has the formula CH3OH. And because this group here is a methyl group, and this group here is the alcohol, the way that we abbreviate that is we abbreviate it ME, lowercase ME, capital O, capital H. So that abbreviation is taken from this part here, from the ME, from the methyl, and then that alcohol portion from the OH that indicates to us what it is. Ethanol, same sort of thing. Ethanol is CH3CH2OH. And so this group here is an ethyl group. That's where the ethanol component comes from. So the standard abbreviation is capital E lowercase T-OH, ethanol. Propanol. Which actually has two different names. It has the official IUPAC name, 2-propanol, but it also has isopropanol. And this one is better if I draw it. I'll do it this way. This will work. CH3, and off of this carbon is the alcohol. The name is taken from this part. They use the ISO and the PR, and then they'll grab the OL. So it becomes capital P, lowercase r, and then a superscripted I that's in front of the P, isopropanol. Or sometimes what you'll see is they'll just use a lowercase I in front, which indicates isopropanol. So the alcohols wind up being abbreviated that way. Acetone, as I was saying before, there is no abbreviation for acetone. Some of the other solvents that we commonly use, though, there are diethyl ether. Diethyl ether is a common solvent. It has ethyl groups on either side of an oxygen. I think I did. Mistake there, this should be a 2. So this one, again, we see that ethyl group. And there's 2 of those ethyl groups. So what we do is we do E, lowercase t, subscript 2, O is the abbreviation, meaning that there's 2 of those ethyl groups and they're both attached to the oxygen. So a common abbreviation for acetone. Let's see, what other solvents do we have? Ethyl acetate is another common one. Ethyl acetate has CH3, CH2, O, this is bound to a carbon, bound to a CH3 group. So this part is the ethyl group. This part is the acete group. And so this one we abbreviate ACOET. As ethyl acetate. Or actually, I did that in reverse. I don't know why I did that. I was trying to think. It's been so long since I've been in the lab. It's been 2 years since I've been in the lab. I'm going to be rusty as well. ETOAC, much better for ethyl acetate. I'm trying to think if there's any others that I need to give you. We'll do a few more as we get into lab, when I introduce new solvents. If there's an abbreviation that's commonly used for that solvent, I'll give you the abbreviation for it. But these are common abbreviations that, when placed on a label, make perfect sense to anybody who knows what they're dealing with. And so no matter how short the container is going to be used, how short a time the container is going to be used, the container always needs to be labeled. And oftentimes what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a lot of samples in a test tube rack. So a lot of times what we'll see is that you may have 10 or 15 test tubes, and they may be all side by side. And a lot of times what people want to do is they want to label them A, B, C, D. And they say, well, in my laboratory notebook, I have them all labeled out. And I know what tests they are because they're in my laboratory notebook. And that would be incorrect, because if there's a spill, we don't want to have to go to your laboratory notebook to try to figure out what those samples are. So instead of doing it that way, if there's a spill and we can't communicate with you, we don't immediately know what those things are looking at them. So instead, what I would like to see is that each one of these is labeled out appropriately. And so oftentimes, like in our first experiment, we'll be doing mixtures of solvents in order to test solubility. And so each one of these should have a label, a piece of tape. And that piece of tape is going to tell us what each one of these are. And you might have to write fairly small, but we need enough information to be able to tell us what this thing is. ET2O, MEOH, ETOH, ETOAC, so that we know what the solvent is that is in each one of these. And that's more what we're looking for. So that if something happens, we know that what we need to do in order to clearly clean these things up really quickly. Does that make sense? And as I said, it is important that that no matter how short a time something is going to be placed into a container, that container must have a label when it's sitting on the desktop, so that everything is labeled appropriately, so that we know what everything is. And clearly too, because you're going to have a lot of different samples, sometimes you get into the habit of placing them in a specific order, thinking, all right, I'm going to use this one, this one, this one, and I know what they all are. And for some reason, the order gets switched and things get messed up. And you forget what is what, or you get pulled away for some reason for a short period of time, helping somebody else with an accident that they may have had. And in the process, forget what order you have things placed. So trying to rely on your memory is never an appropriate situation. You always need to have labels on everything. With that too, a lot of times we're doing chemical reactions. And so when we have a chemical reaction that's taking place, how do we label a chemical reaction, given that there may be a lot of different constituents in that chemical reaction? So one of the types of things that we may see here is that on a chemical reaction itself, we label what the reaction is that's going on. This thing may be set up such that there's a ring stand that is clamping the device in many different areas. This thing may be heated, and so we may have some sort of sand bath that is on this thing. And then we clearly wouldn't be able to visualize through that sand bath. This may be sitting on a hot plate. And as I said, it may be that it is being heated through that hot plate. And all of this sits on a jack stand and is elevated up off the table. And so what we typically do in labeling reactions like this is that we'll create a label. If the hot plate isn't being used and it's not hot, sometimes we'll put the label on the hot plate. Sometimes we'll take and we'll put the label down here on the jack stand in front of the hot plate. and we'll tell what that label is. So oftentimes that label, even though it's on a piece of tape, we can draw out what that label looks like. We may have a chemical reaction that is taking place that is drawn out in line diagrams. And tells us everything that's happening in that chemical reaction. And with a good mechanical pencil, we can get in everything that we need to get. It might be a little tight, but it generally works out. And if we need to use multiple pieces of tape, then we use multiple pieces of tape. But we get the label in there so that we can see what's actually going on. If the hot plate is not hot, then the label can go here, right on the hot plate. And that just makes it because it's too hard sometimes to get the label onto the glassware, that the glassware, what needs to be included on the label in this case, because there's so many different components that are in there in a chemical reaction that's actually taking place, it's more appropriate to try to use a larger label associated with the reaction mechanism so that we have a clear indication of what's actually going on inside that reaction and what's there. Is that being clear so far? So the differences between labeling samples and tests that we do and labeling chemical reactions, that all of those things need to be labeled. And oftentimes I mentioned pipettes before. I should include that with those solvent pipettes, that oftentimes we will reuse the pipettes on multiple days. So that solvents will evaporate out of the pipette. And with certain solvents, it's okay to reuse the pipette for multiple weeks, going back to the same pipette for the same solvent. And because the solvents evaporate out cleanly, oftentimes what we do is we include a label that's here that may have ETOH ethanol, that we just get to reuse that pipette for multiple weeks. Some solvents, we can't reuse them. Some solvents are sticky, or when we use them for a solution that has a dissolved solid in it, that dissolved solid leaves a residue within the pipette. Pipettes are hard to clean. Those pipettes we will dispose of. But for clean solvents, we'll reuse them. And I'll let you know what solvents it's appropriate for and which solvents it's not once we're actually in lab and working with those types of things. Okay, anybody have any questions on sample labels? All right, let's talk about waste labels. Waste labels are harder, and waste is governed by HAZCOM. So there's a way that the waste needs to be labeled correctly. And waste is one of those things that they don't mess around with. If you have an OSHA inspection come through the lab and the waste containers are not labeled correctly, it can be hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines, if not millions of dollars in fines. It is one of the things that they really do not mess around with. De Anza College at one point had had an OSHA complaint and an inspection, and their waste containers were unreadable in terms of the labels. And they incurred hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines because those waste labels were not properly done and were not readable. And they were doing everything that they could think of to make the waste labels readable. What was happening is they were labeling the bottles with pen, and they were writing directly onto the bottle, labeling it with pen. And the solvent vapors that were coming out of the waste bottles were causing the pen to bleed and to be unreadable within a matter of weeks. And so sometimes we store these waste containers for many weeks. Sometimes it could be 3 months or 6 months before the materials are actually disposed of with a company that comes in and removes them and then takes them to a facility where they're combusted and destroyed. And the labels need to survive until that time that they're handed off. And what was happening is in those weeks that they were being stored, the solvent vapors in the storage facility were destroying the labels, and the labels were unreadable. And they were doing everything they could think of. They were putting them into plastic. They were putting tape over the top of them. They were trying to protect the labels. And you know what they didn't think of? An easy solution, a really, really cheap, easy solution. You write the label in pencil. Use a pencil. It's, I always tell this little story, which is not actually accurate, but close enough. It serves the purpose that that the Americans, when going into space, needed utensils for their astronauts to be able to write and take notes and do everything. And so they spent millions of dollars designing a pen that can write in space. Pens function by the use of gravity and the attraction of ink to paper. And when you hold the pen upright, the gravity allows the ink to flow down. But in zero gravity, the ink doesn't flow. And so they needed to design a pressurized pen that the ink component was pressurized, and yet the ink would not flow out through the tip of the pen. Spent millions of dollars designing a pen that could write in space and that could write upside down and all of these things. And the Russians just used a pencil. Sometimes the solution is an easy solution. So the graphite is not attacked by organic solvents and is always readable and never fails. And so everything must be labeled in pencil. We use a couple of different types of solvent containers for waste, and they generally reside in the fume hood. We have these containers that are called eco funnels. They have a lid that fits on them and a little latch container on that lid. And inside, underneath that lid, is a funnel component. These then are designed to attach to bottles of certain sizes. We usually use them on a 4-liter glass bottle. So they're fairly large bottles that we're collecting that waste in. The bottles oftentimes have a glass ring handle. And these need to have certain components on the labels. So I'm going to do the label bigger so that we see sort of what goes on that label. It gets a start date. We always want to know when the bottle was first, when waste was first starting to be placed into the bottle so that we can know the overall age of the material that's there. So we always have a start date. It needs to have the word hazard. And then the type of waste. So usually this is organic. We would put the pictograms on there. The staff is going to take care of those pictograms and what pictograms are appropriate. It may have the signal word in there, danger. And it might have some hazard statements. But then most importantly, what we need to do is we need to know what the contents of that is. And so that there's another tag that we normally affix to the bottle. Sometimes the tag is affixed to the handle. Sometimes the tag is affixed around the neck of the flask. And it really depends upon who affixed that tag. Those tags, I'm going to put the tag over here as if it's coming off of this part. The tag is wired on. And on this waste tag, there are all the different constituents that have been placed into that waste container. And let me show you what the tags actually look like. They're yellow in color. We do them all uniform. They're a lot smaller than this. I'm going to zoom out so that they are here. This part in the front is filled out by stockroom staff. So this side is filled out by stockroom staff. It's usually filled out at the completion of the waste, when the waste is done. So normally what gets filled out here is something that the originator is the department, chemistry, and the division, natural applied sciences. The phone number is the phone number of the stockroom that we put on here. We usually use a room that is the stockroom room and the date. This would be the completed date. The hazards that are here, these are for pictograms. And then we have a tracking number and other information that goes on there. This is the side that is important for us. So this is the important side. Each of the chemicals that you place into the container must be written on this side of the label. We don't need the percentages, but each chemical must be designated on this side of the label. So the chemical names not formulas, must be by name. I don't know if I can write that here. I can't. So I need to maybe I can. I'll bring them one more time and see if I can get it smaller so that I can write next to it. But no abbreviations. No formulas. Must be the full name of the chemical. I was going to put another chemical in there, but let's leave it this way. These percentages will be added later by the instructor. So your job is to look at the label and to see if the chemical that you're placing into the container is on the label already. If the chemical is on the label, then you may place your chemical into that container without doing anything else. If your chemical is not listed on the label, then you must list it using a pencil, writing it on the label that indicates that that material has been added to the jar. And as I said, what I tend to do is, because we're using these as a standard part of the organic curriculum, I know the percentages that are used by the class for all of the experiments, and I go back and I add the percentages later on. If anything is different from what we generally use in the class, for instance, let's say that I need to dispose of 250 mils of acetone that was contaminated, then what I'll do is I'll go and I'll put in those 250 mils of acetone into the container, and I may increase this percentage based on what I'm adding. Or I may put a volume next to it such that it can help me to figure out the percentage later. But for most experiments, I know what the class uses percentage-wise, and I go in and I complete these percentages. And these percentages must all total 100%. So that there can be no missing percentages. This part down here is completed by the stockroom staff later. When the bottle is completed and they're getting ready to waste it out, they go in and they put in the different physical states that that sample represents. They put in the hazard class, whether it's flammable, poison, oxidized, or reactive. For liquids, they'll take the pH of the liquid and write the pH down. If there's something specific in nature, they will write that down. So all of that gets completed later on. But this is what you're responsible for right here. It is just making sure that the chemical name is on that label. Okay. And along with this, I should say that we have a couple of different hazardous waste streams. We generally have two of these in the waste fume hood. So in the waste fume hood, we generally have two bottles that are exactly the same size. They look almost identical. And then there's a third container that is a 5-gallon bucket, or might be smaller than 5 gallons, a little bit smaller. And this bucket sits in the fume hood. And it also has a tag on the front and then a waste tag that comes off the side. The first one of these containers is usually hazardous aqueous waste. The second one is hazardous organic waste. And this one is hazardous solid waste. Okay, anybody know the difference between aqueous and organic? Any ideas?
It's organic, like just pure organic waste, and the aqueous waste is like mixed in with something else.
Close.
Mixed in with water or something.
Water.
Okay.
That's the key thing. Okay, so it has to do with water. So aqueous waste, this is waste that is is compatible with water. The word that we use is miscible. So we'll say either dissolves in water or is miscible with water. So those two words, dissolves in water or miscible, both of those mean very similar. When we say dissolves, we usually mean a solid dissolves into water. The idea here is that it's homogeneous with water. That's the key thing. We don't want the waste to become biphasic. We don't want the waste to separate. So anything that goes in the aqueous waste are things that are dissolved in water. So these may be things like aqueous sodium hydroxide, dissolved in water. These may be things like sodium chloride that are aqueous, dissolved in water. This may be things like methanol, because methanol is completely miscible with water, or ethanol that has water in it. Acetone can go in here. All of these things are compatible with water. What cannot go in here? So these are all okay. Things like this, salts, alcohols, acetone. What's not okay is other organic solvents, things like diethyl ether. Hexane, toluene. These are things that are organic of nature that will separate from water, that will become immiscible. So that hazardous organic waste, this is waste that is compatible with organic materials. So I'm going to use, I used blue there for sort of okay. Usually my go-to color is red for organic waste. I'm going to do it in purple. This is waste that dissolves in organic solvents. This is homogeneous with organic solvents. So again, this can be things like, these can be organic solids that are dissolved in solution. So we may see solid names on here. I'm trying to think of, biphenyl. Triphenyl methanol. These are things that are dissolved in solvents. Acetone as a solvent, methanol. Without water, not an aqueous solution. Ethanol with no water. This I should say, no water. Other solvents that may be in here may be hexane, toluene, those types of things. And what does not go in here? No water, no salts. Those are things that don't belong within the organic waste. So notice that that there's a lot of things here on this list that were on both lists, because some things are compatible with water and some things are compatible with organic, and they could go either direction. Methanol, as long as it's aqueous, should go into the aqueous waste if it's mixed with water. But if it's methanol that has no water in it, then it can go into the organic waste. So really the question is about water, and that aqueous, that is the key right there, that that aqueous implies water, and that the organic solvent is the absence of water, not water compatible. And the idea here is that we're just trying to make the waste be homogeneous, uniform, so that it doesn't separate into clear phases. That's what we're trying to avoid. So usually what I do is when we start an experiment, I detail out where everything goes at the end and how it is to be disposed of. But if there's ever any question into how something is to be disposed of, then the proper thing is to ask where it goes before disposing of it. Don't come and ask after. Ask before, so that we know where it goes and that it goes in the right place. And along those lines, nothing ever goes down the drain. Everything has a waste stream and a waste place that it goes. These solid wastes, these are for solid samples that have no solvent. So these solid samples are going to be things like the biphenyl, the triphenyl methanol that were not placed into a solvent. They're just the dry powder material. So these are dry solids, I should say. That's what goes into that container. And then we have one more waste stream that I should mention that's not on this list. And that one more waste stream is one that we don't need to be as careful about labeling. It's just a safety precaution of where things go. Within the lab, we always have a cardboard container that's got an open lid like this. And there is usually a flap that makes it so that it's sort of like a one-way trip. And this is for broken glassware. So the broken glassware box, this is for clean broken glassware. Meaning that we don't like to put heavily contaminated glassware in there because it sits outside the fume hood and it can be a source of strong odors, of strong chemical odors if we're throwing glassware that is in there that has been contaminated. So usually if we have a piece of broken glassware, what we try to do is rinse the chemicals off of it into the waste container before disposing of the broken glass into the glassware container. The same goes for pipettes, that we oftentimes throw our pipettes in here. This is the proper waste place for used pipettes. And one of the most common disposal things that we do, that we dispose of these used glass pipettes, these guys, what we do is we rinse with acetone into the organic waste. Then dispose of. In broken glassware box. Okay, but then the other things that we'll dispose of here might be things like a round bottom that gets a star crack in it. So a star crack is a specific type of damage to a round bottom. It looks like a glinting star. And what we'll do is we'll wash that round bottom first, rinsing it with acetone to get any contaminants out of the round bottom, and then dispose of the round bottom in the broken glassware. And so it's easy enough to rinse and clean that before disposing of it so that it doesn't go in with all of its chemical contents. So we just want to make sure that what's ever going into that broken glassware container, that it doesn't have strong solvent smells on it at the time that it goes in. And that's pretty much our four waste streams. We have aqueous, organic, solid, and then all broken glassware that goes into the broken glassware box rather than the trash. And I guess I should include the trash cans. So what goes in the trash can then? Because we do have trash cans in the classroom. So what's allowed to go in the trash can? If all of my aqueous waste goes in that container, I've got my organic waste, I've got my hazardous solid waste, which is all the solid samples and things, broken glassware goes in the broken glassware box, what goes in the trash can? almost nothing. Almost nothing goes in the trash can. Because everything else has a waste stream. Here's what can go in the trash can. Non-soiled paper, meaning these could be paper towels that you're drying your hands with. These are paper towels that you're drying off the table with. Basically, paper towels that were used to dry water. Gloves can go in here. As long as not heavily soiled from a spill. What else goes in here? Tape labels, used tape labels. Trying to think if there's much else that goes in here that you generate within the laboratory, and there really isn't. That's pretty much it. Everything else chemical related goes in a chemical place. So the one thing that we don't want to do, and I should note this up here, this waste here, this solid waste, this is expensive. This is for chemicals. So these are all dry chemicals. These are heavily soiled gloves. If that happens, this is weighing paper with sticky residue. What it's not is this is not paper towels. Used for water. This is not gloves. Those types of things. We try to divert those into the actual trash waste. Things that are not chemically contaminated. All of those chemically contaminated things do go in there, but things that are not chemically contaminated, sorry, there we go, stop scrolling. Things that are not chemically contaminated get diverted into the regular trash can, into the regular trash stream. And that's the only thing that's allowed to go into the trash can.
Question. So there was a spill, and if you cleaned it up with paper towels and therefore it was contaminated, that would then not go into the trash. That would go into the solid waste, right?
Yeah. Generally, what we try to do is when there's a spill, we generally don't use paper towels per se for the spill, depending upon the size of the spill. And we'll talk more about this in class itself. I can give you a little bit of an idea here, but paper towels are actually a hazard within the lab if used inappropriately. So the question being, paper towels used for drying These go in the trash. Paper towels used for spill. These should go in the solid waste. But it depends upon, again, sort of what was used here. As I said, paper towels present a hazard. Let me document that hazard, and then I'll try to explain how we do this a little bit differently. Paper towels can be a serious hazard. Let me give you an example. I think it was close to 1994, they had a fire at UCSC in the Sinsheimer labs, in the Sinsheimer building. What had happened was a 4-liter bottle of solvent or waste. It was unclear whether it was solvent or waste. I think it was probably waste. This was a 4-liter bottle that broke. When that bottle broke, however it was that it broke, whatever crack happened, the solvent started to spread out. And as the solvent started to spread out into a pool that started to travel, what the graduate students did in the lab is they took paper towels and they tried to surround it with paper towels. As they took and they bunched these paper towels around it, what wound up happening is those paper towels absorbed the material, but what they did is they spread it out and gave it more surface area. For evaporation. They also add fuel. What happened then was they had a refrigerator that was stored nearby, not stored, but in operation. And so this refrigerator, as the solvent went underneath the refrigerator cycled. And the cycling of the refrigerator has a servo that kicks the motor on. That servo gave an arc. And when it arced, it caught everything on fire. And so the solvent then caught fire, but then all of these paper towels added fuel to it. And the fire increased so dramatically because of the added fuel and the added surface area that there was no way to put it out. And it nearly destroyed the building. They had to dump 2 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of water in there to fight the fire. And they were able to save it. One of the floors was destroyed, but massive damage throughout the entire building. And a lot of it was how they dealt with the spill and trying to use paper towels in order to deal with the spill. So because of the fact that paper towels add surface area and add fuel, we typically try not to use paper towels as a first defense in a spill. Usually the correct way let me go down another page. Correct procedure for a spill. Let's say small spill. In a small spill, I'm saying that this is something that is less than or equal to, let's say 10 milliliters. This is okay to use paper towels. These would then, paper towels would be placed in the back of the fume hood, not in the waste container yet. Paper towels should be placed in back of fume hood. To allow for evaporation of solvent. Moved to solid waste after evaporation. Sometimes what happens is when you add a solvent to a paper towel like that, the process of the solvent going into the paper towel can generate heat. When you compact those paper towels into a solid waste container and give them no room for evaporation, that heat can generate significantly enough. You can think about oil and rags that oftentimes the heat can be substantial enough to catch everything on fire and they can spontaneously auto-combust. So as a practice, I like to make sure that the paper towels that we're getting into that solid waste are not wet with solvent and have had a chance to evaporate and dry out in the back of the fume hood. It doesn't mean that the solvent vapors are entirely gone, but at least the bulk of the solvent is gone. And then I move those into the solid waste after they have evaporated. For a spill that's greater than 10 milliliters, it depends on what it is that we've spilled, but procedure for large spills. This is greater than, let's say, less than equal to about 100 mils, maybe 100 to 200. 200 starts getting pretty big. Here, what we want to do is we want to use a material that will absorb the liquid, but not be combustible. So here what we use is vermiculite. L-I-T-E? I have to look up the spelling of it. Vermiculite. This is a diatomaceous earth material. It is absorbent, but not.
I use a lot of diatomaceous earth in my chicken coop to keep it from getting super, I guess, moist in there because the chickens poop a lot. So we throw it in like their nest boxes and on everything.
Interesting. I've never thought of using that with chickens. But I suppose you absolutely could. So this is absorbent, but not flammable. And because of that, it's an excellent material in order to absorb those liquids that contain them. And then we sweep up the solid material.
Yeah, I need to do this at the gas station I work at whenever there's a gas spill.
Same thing, exactly. And dispose of into a proper waste container. In our case, it would be the solid waste container.
Is dark spacious earth like what's in cat litter? Because one time I blew up my rear differential on my Suburban and the diff fluid went everywhere.
Yep.
And the guy, the tow truck driver, threw what I thought was cat litter all over the diff fluid.
Absolutely. Cat litter is the other go-to material that if you don't have vermiculite on hand, then cat litter is a more dense material because vermiculite is very fluffy, very very light, and can be quite dusty. And so the cat litter is a much more dense material. It's the same sort of thing. It's still a diatomaceous earth material that absorbs without being combustible. And so cat litter is the other go-to. And in fact, in a lot of labs, they'll use the cat litter. We use the vermiculite because whenever they send us samples, the samples or the materials are oftentimes packed in a metal canister with diatomaceous earth inside that canister. And so you're dumping out the diatomaceous earth in order to get at the bottle. We just keep dumping it into a bucket. And then that bucket of diatomaceous earth is what we use in case of a spill. And so it's just in the laboratory and it's labeled as such for spills. Okay, depending upon what is spilled, if it's larger than 200 milliliters or of a particular hazard class, then I either decide that I can clean it up and I get you guys out of the room. And so I may evacuate the room and then I will attempt to clean it. Or we all evacuate the room and we just dial 911 and we have somebody with the proper gear to come in and clean it up, depending upon how large it is. So larger spills, we evacuate. And with that, whenever you have a spill, I classify that as an emergency. You should be getting my attention immediately. And I'll take a look at the spill. I'll evaluate and decide, is it something that I'm going to teach you how to deal with? Or is it something that is of a particular hazard that I need to deal with it immediately? And there's no time to teach you how to deal with it. An instance of this was something like a piperine experiment. Piperine is the active material that is in pepper. And we used to do an extraction of piperine from pepper. And it was a fairly large scale experiment. We would use something like 250 grams of pepper and nearly an equivalent volume of solvent of ethanol, 200 to 300 milliliters of ethanol. And in the process of recrystallization at one point, one student had a spill of the concentrated piperine solvent on the hot plate. The hot plate vaporized the piperine, which became much like a tear gas. You couldn't get close to it. You couldn't breathe because it was so choking. It was a lacrimator, caused your eyes to water. Got into your respiratory system and caused uncontrollable choking. And there wasn't any time to teach the student how to deal with the situation. I just had to get everybody out of the classroom. And then I had to go back in the classroom and try to get those materials into a fume hood where they could actually be dealt with. That there was too much it was just too difficult a situation to use as a teaching situation. So sometimes we need to get people out of there and deal with the larger spills. But anything that's small, I will definitely teach you how to do rather than just doing it for you and show you the right way to go through and clean those things up. But diatomaceous earth is a preferred material or cat litter as opposed to paper towels for anything that's of a larger size, just so that we don't add flammable material and create an additional fire hazard. So we try not to go for paper towels as a first off thing, unless the spill is really small. Okay. Let's see, we've been going for about an hour and a half. And I think we've covered just about everything that I want to cover. Let me stop here for a minute. This is something that I don't feel terribly bad about if we just do class for an hour and a half as opposed to 3 hours. Usually in a 3-hour lab, we don't do 3 hours of lecture. In a 3-hour lab, we usually do 45 minutes to an hour, maybe an hour and a bit worth of lecture. And then the rest of it is active working. So trying to fill a 3-hour lab period with enough lecture to keep you guys occupied here for 3 hours seems inappropriate. So I think if there's any other questions, we can deal with any of the questions. The other thing that we can do is take a break here. And if we want to come back and we want to use a little bit of this time to work on some lecture material and treat it sort of like extended office hours, I'm happy to do that for a little bit as well. So let me ask if there's anything that I haven't covered or that has brought up any questions about the waste situation and labeling and where things go.
I have one question. Maybe it's more simple than I'm thinking, but you were saying that aqueous has to do with being miscible with water. Is it the same thing as a liquid? Is aqueous and liquid the same thing?
Aqueous and liquid are not the same thing. That's a great question, actually. So what do we mean when we say something is liquid? So there's a liquid state. Let me go back and share screen. I want to get these into the notes. And that's a common thing to ask about. Okay, difference between liquid and aqueous. Liquid is about a state. So water can be liquid, but so can methanol. So can toluene or hexane. These can all be liquids. And so liquid is a state of matter that refers to what that state is, solid, liquid, gas. So any of these organic materials can be liquid. Aqueous which I spelled wrong. Aqueous. There we go. Aqueous is a solution in water. So things that are aqueous are things that are dissolved in water. Sodium chloride, AQ. Ammonium hydroxide, AQ. But these could also be things that are methanol dissolved in water or ethanol dissolved in water. So these are solutions in water with water as a solvent. That's what aqueous means. Aqueous really means water as a solvent. So they are in a liquid state, but they are not a single component. They're a solution.
Oh, that makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's a great question. Any other questions while I've still got the screen share up? Okay, so I think what I'm going to propose here is that, let me kill the screen share. I think what I'm going to propose here is that this will end the content for the class for the lab component. And then what I'll do is we'll take a break here. And anybody who wants to treat this sort of like extended office hours and to work on any material for the lecture or any other material, we'll come back at maybe 9:40. What do I need here? Yeah, let's come back at 9:40. And we can treat it sort of as extended office hours or help for anything else. And other than that, I'm gonna turn you guys loose and let you go. And I think this is enough content for today. Sound like a plan? Everybody on board? All right, sounds good. All right, I'm gonna put it for a break until 9:40. I'll put some music on. I'll come back. And if people are here and they wanna treat it as office hours, that's great. If not, and everybody takes off, then I'm gonna go ahead and end the session. So I won't be here. So if you like try to come back into the session and think, oh, maybe he's still doing that open-ended office hours thing. No, I'm gonna turn it off at that point and then I'll see you at office hours. But if anybody wants to stick around, I'm happy to do that. And I'll be back on here at 9:40, okay? All right, thanks for a good session. Thanks for good questions. And I'll see you either in office hours or I'll see you when we come back here in a little bit.